You are listening to the Power of Why podcast.
And I loved those negotiations and deals. I had a really unique and thoughtful negotiating strategy. It was always outcome-based. It was always like, okay, how do we get the best deal on the table? But my starting point was never about how do we get everything we want? It was how do we figure out what the other side wants and marry it against what we want and create a scenario where the outcome is actually greater.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Power of Why podcast. My name is Naomi Hailey, and today we are here with Mona Minhas. Mona, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Naomi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here with you.
I'm so excited for us to delve in. I really reflect back on our first conversation. And even though we were meeting for the first time, I feel like we connected on so many fronts, whether it's like our creative energy or our love for business and connecting with people. And what I gleaned from you was your brilliant perspectives when it comes to being a lifelong learner and just your desire to help people. And so I want to start by sharing a little snapshot of your career and some of the incredible things that you've been working on, and then we'll get to know you a little bit more. So for the audience, Mona Minhas is a partner with the Thrive Venture Fund at BDC. Thrive Venture Fund is a $300 million fund that invests in women-led technology companies that are solving some of the world's biggest problems. Prior to that, Mona was a former operator and fractional CFO and COO. She's worked with several recognized venture-backed startups and founders, helping them grow and scale their businesses and also secure capital. She's also an advising partner to Women's Equity Lab, a Canada-wide angel investment fund that supports investing in early-stage companies. Mona is also an advisor and mentor to several startups in the ecosystem. She's extremely passionate and an advocate for entrepreneurs and companies that are driving a meaningful impact. And I think that's at the center of how you operate, how you see the world. And so again, thrilled that you're here. I would love if you could share a little bit about your origin story, Mona. Could you tell us a little bit about how you grew up? What did you love doing as a kid?
For sure. The humble beginnings, I guess. So look, it's no secret. I'm a first generation Canadian. I was born to immigrant parents. And, you know, pretty much the typical story, came here with very little in their pockets. And I was an only child for a long time, almost 10 years. And I think especially in those early years, I really began to recognize the complexity of my own identity, especially when I was in school. I was that kid that was packed like really fragrant lunches that looked different.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone kind of snarled at them, but it was very comforting to me. I wore my hair in braids that were really, you know, it was very familiar at home and in my culture and almost ritual, but, you know, definitely not common at school and kind of made me stick out. And so when I kind of reflect on those beginnings, I think I had to learn to coexist as a nonconformist, if you will. Mm-hmm. Right, when we think about nonconformists, we always think about them as being rebellious in nature and deliberately rebellious in nature. But I've always been a bit of a nonconformist, but one that can also coexist, you know, with everyone else. So anyway, I guess more on that later. And I think what's really inherent in the South Asian culture is just making sure that you blend in, you don't cause too much disruption. So, you know, definitely kind of making sure you blend into the rest of the room. But anyway, I think that's been a part of my part of my DNA growing up. And we talked a little bit about this before, but, you know, creativity's always been a huge part of who I am. And I don't know exactly where it came from. Like, I think these things are partially genetic. And I also think they're partially born out of passion and your environment. So mm-hmm. I'm sure there's some combination of that in there. But I love music. I love art. Growing up, I could listen to music on my dad's record player's 8-track machine with like his old giant headphones for hours and hours and hours. Like that Thriller album, Michael Jackson. Like, I could like tell you about like every single line drawn on that album cover art. And honestly, today, so many years later, you can still find me doing that in my my happy place. It's really interesting. Like headphones, and you know, I still own a record player and I collect vinyl. So, but I think just kind of stemming on my origins and why that creativity has been important, was important, and why it's still important is when you think about creativity, you think about the arts, the one word that keeps coming up is possibility, right? The idea that anything is possible if you imagine it, you know, and you imagine it in your mind, you can imagine it on paper, you can imagine it in song, you can imagine it in so many different ways. And I think that idea of possibilities always created a sense of vision and excitement for me around imagining that things can be huger than I even imagine or think about in my mind, you know, and that's just really inspiring. So I think, you know, creativity in the form of arts, but also just in terms of like in my mind has always been something that's a part of who I am.
Wow. That's probably like, no, I can't say that on record, but that's probably one of the most beautiful origin stories I've ever heard. Oh, and you tying together the things you noticed and the things that you were curious about and the things that you loved. And it seems like you also got like it was okay to dream and got lost in that as well, which I think growing up can be, especially in a household of people who are coming here to, you know, coming to a new country, like similarly, my parents as well. I know I had experiences of tossing between the two, that creative spirit and also that like being in the here and now. And I understand from you in our last conversation, your upbringing, math and science and like the analytical side of you was also emphasized. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you held both, which I think is also like very natural too, right? How did you hold both as you went through school and ultimately decided what you wanted to study?
I think, you know, one of the outcomes of being a child of immigrant parents is the mindset is they want you to be better off than they were, right? And being better off than they were and moving to a whole other country and leaving families behind is certainly not about becoming a musician or an actor or any of those things. But truly, I think maybe had I had a blank canvas, who knows what would have happened there. And yeah, so I was given those pathways that often immigrant parents give their children, which is you can go into medicine, you can go into engineering, or you can go into accounting. And I was really kind of given, you know, some of those options. I think what was interesting is I realized, you know, as in my studies, and I wasn't always good at school, which is interesting. And then I just sort of really flourished in academia. Like there was, I think maybe when I moved into adolescence, I started to take pride. You kind of talked about lifelong learning. I started to take pride in like becoming a master of many things and learning about many things and then figuring out how does math connect to English? How does English connect to science? How does science connect to world issues? Like, honestly, it was always about piecing those things together for me, which actually made me really enjoy almost every single subject that I learned and studied, which, you know, I guess is interesting. One thing I always maintained for a very long time, and even to this day in career and when things get technical, is I still really continue to stoke that creative side of me. So even in my early studies, I would continue to take like 3 English courses because like it wasn't just about core English. It was about writer's craft, specific literature studies. And that continued throughout, you know, the course of my studies, right? Like I studied art history. I studied all kinds of things, you know, again, that would stoke my imagination and actually help me excel in some of those other more technical studies. And I think that's actually made me, when you kind of think about career and career path, that's helped me see perspectives when I'm at a table that not everyone sees. When I, you know, studied and became, you know, went into my first sort of professional role, I studied accounting and I became a chartered accountant and CPA. And I can tell you the number of people that have said to me, you do not seem like a typical. I have heard that hundreds and hundreds of times. They don't come across as being a typical, you know, anything. And I think that comes from this idea of having a perspective that like brings in different disciplines of thinking that puts myself in the other person's shoes. You know, when I think about a problem, I don't think about myself sitting there as a spectator and like analyzing something around how to solve it. I often imagine myself in the arena, inside the eye of the hurricane of the problem, thinking about what are all the things that I need to think about here, and then stepping back out and then figuring out how to solve it. So I think that's been pretty unique in terms of, you know, how I've always thought about things. So while I, you know, went into a very technical profession, right, studied accounting, went into finance, went into business, like, yeah, I'm like super strong technically, but then I'm also very, I think, thoughtful about the whole people equation and how I think about people and how I think about dynamics, how I think about business. When I worked in corporate M&A, buying companies, selling companies, the most interesting feedback I was always given is you get to walk in the room and negotiate these huge multi-million dollar deals. But one of the pieces of feedback is that I had a really unique and thoughtful negotiating strategy. It was always outcome-based. It was always like, okay, how do we get the best deal on the table? But my starting point was never about how do we get everything we want? It was how do we figure out what the other side wants and marry it against what we want and create a scenario where the outcome is actually greater than what we both wanted to begin with. I credit that again to some of my creative thinking and love of creativity. And I loved those negotiations and deals. Some of them went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, but it was always so amazing to end that process and feel like the sum was greater than the proverbial parts in that, you know? So yeah, I don't know if I've answered the question. I think I went off way on a tangent there. You might have asked about career journey, and I'm happy to talk about that too. But I think the important thing is I've never fit a mold and I've never felt like I had to fit a mold. And I've felt like I could sit in a chair and a role that on paper might seem really typical, but I could operate completely atypically. And that was the real value add, you know, in terms of, I think what helped me accelerate my career so quickly.
Fascinating. That point you brought up around negotiations or having these, really at the end of the day, they're conversations, right? That you said could extend weeks upon weeks, and bringing in just a different way of relationship building. And I'm wondering what we can learn from your approach in our day-to-day life, because arguably we're negotiating every single day, whether you realize it or not. And so what have you learned about people and asking questions to get to the crux of what people really want and what they're looking for?
You just nailed it when you said asking questions. And I think you do this so well. Like at the heart of what you do is you're insightful and you ask a lot of questions. And I think as humans, we make a lot of assumptions. We make assumptions that somebody wants X or Y, or but because they came from a certain place, they're going to want to do something else next. And we are really guilty about making assumptions around what people want. And I approach it with a lot of curiosity, right? And it's like, yeah, you hear people say, I'm such a curious person, and it's really cliche. And we all come across with curiosity in different ways. And I'm super curious about that human dynamic, right? And thinking about what motivates you. Like, you know, when I talk to founders and entrepreneurs in my day job right now, one of my first questions is like, why? Why did you start the business? And if they say, well, the market for this product is amazing and we're solving a big problem. And I say, hold on, hold on, time out. No, I mean, why? Why in your heart and in your mind was this the thing you wanted to put everything into? Your heart, your soul, like all of it. Like, why? And that one question, what it unlocks and what people share with you and tell you, is so insightful. And when you ask, just ask questions, to go back to your point, it's amazing what people will share with you because you cared to ask, you were interested and curious enough to ask. And then you can kind of think about, well, how does that connect to maybe what I would like to do, or how I can help you, or how you can help me? It's a completely different dimension around doing business that I think I've just inherently adopted.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I love your perspectives and just how you see the world, because I think in the world of business, and I'd love to get into, you know, so much of your brilliance and your energy you've dedicated to advising founders and providing, you know, your CFO and your accounting and your systems brain to help companies scale and launch new products and get ready for capital raises and so much more. What was a memory that you have where you came into contact with business building where you're like, wow, we were able to take an idea and build it into something real, or, you know, bring it to life?
What's really interesting is I would almost take it right back to some of my very humble beginnings. I was an articling student at PwC, Big Four accounting firm, and I was articling to become a chartered accountant. So it's kind of like in an apprenticeship. And when you're in an apprenticeship, you know, I did everything from photocopying hundreds and hundreds of pages of like management reports at 2 a.m. and getting the partner's lunch at like the Indian buffet across the street. Like, I would literally do everything. And I kind of had my first epiphany. Honestly, I think it was like 1:30 a.m. and I was like photocopying reams and reams of paper, questioning my entire life's existence and wondering why I'd bothered to even go to school and like all that stuff. And I just stood there and I decided to just start reading the stuff I was photocopying. I was like, what is this stuff that I'm photocopying? And I realized it was like a prospectus, which is what a company puts together when it's about to issue shares on the stock exchange. And I was like, well, what is this? How does this work? And I started reading everything top to bottom and started to understand like how the company was telling its story to sell its shares on the public market, the journey it had undertaken, the price it was about to list its shares, the company's value, like all that stuff, which is really interesting. And I realized as I was doing this that, like, I feel like you can't become a deep expert in everything in life, but you can actually learn a lot about different things just by making an effort to like figure it out. Like, my attitude starts to become, how hard can this be to learn? I'm not going to be a deep expert at it, but maybe I can learn a thing or two about it. And that was like a really interesting first formative experience. It stands out in my mind only because, you know, the image of me all dressed up and still in my suit from like 7 a.m. at the photocopying machine. And then I went on to kind of apply that mindset in so many of my different roles, right? What was really interesting is I was the CFO and COO for Nixware, which is a really incredible Canadian success story. And when I joined Nix, my job was very, very multifaceted, right? In addition to dealing with all the financial stuff, I had to help support the supply chain and operations and importing goods from China. And like, do you think I knew anything about any of that stuff? Zero. I absolutely had no idea. And I was pretty out of my depth. But I looked around me and I realized everybody here is out of their depth. What's everyone doing? We're all just like investing a ton of time to learn it and figure it out. And so even if it meant burning the candle at both ends, my commitment has always been to learn and then apply it into a business context, right? So what do I infer from this? So what? Now what? How do I use this to solve a problem? I need to think like I'm an expert in this domain. And if I'm not, how can I be resourceful to learn more? So to answer your question, I think first kind of formative experience was just about, you know, not assuming you're not an expert in something and you can't learn something was like, and that spans across, it's allowed me to relate to different people in different functions. I can talk to people on engineering teams, right? And I can talk to them in their language. I can talk to people on sales teams, on product teams, on marketing teams. And while I don't profess to be a niche expert, I can still talk to them and understand them and hold up a pretty reasonable conversation. So that's been that multidisciplinary, coming back, that multidisciplinary thing. It's possible for anyone to do that. So that's been my biggest aha.
So because you're curious, and I mean, we heard it in your origin story, your desire to learn about theater and art history and all of these different avenues. And so regardless of whatever environment you're in, it seems like this is just a natural way that you operate. I'm wondering, for people who may not be in a position that demands they touch multiple functions, how can they integrate that type of thinking and approach if they're working at a, you know, 10,000 strong organization and are very much like a cog in a company? Yeah, what would you say to those folks?
It's interesting because I too, many years ago, was a cog in a company, and most finance people never ventured past that area of cubicles, right? It was like you just never did. And to be honest, I actually challenge that thinking. And I think even if you're on an engineering team or a marketing team, figure out how you can join one of their meetings once a month, right? Like figure out what they're talking about, you know, take advantage of the fact that you're in such a large organization, and like figure out whether you can join a weekly meeting, rotate through those different functional areas, absorb in the strategy. Like when the CEO is like, you know, putting out strategic direction, and then make it your mission to say, you know, I really want to understand what these three things mean, even though it's outside of my comfort zone. Those are like, I think you have to have a lot of initiative and you have to have an interest in self-learning to do that. So that's one thing I would suggest, is like really defying that assumption that I have to stay in my box. Of course, you have to stay in your box and be really good at your role. No one is saying you join a certain function with the intention of having five other jobs. That's not at all what I'm saying. But do your job really well and then figure out how you can actually start integrating yourself into other functions, you know, across the company if you so choose. But the other thing I would say is, if that doesn't appeal to you, because that's just, everyone is so different, there's nothing stopping you from becoming a really, really deep domain expert at what you do if you're really passionate about it. Like maybe you're in marketing, maybe you're in growth marketing, and you're like, I love this with a passion. I can't stop thinking about it. I'm results driven. I want to, like, you know, aim for higher and higher targets every week. Everything I'm doing is working really well. Figure out how you can become an even deeper domain expert at what you do. And like, you can become an expert in your own right, the person, the go-to person that people think of, not only in that job, in that company, but maybe in the industry, right?
Absolutely.
Think really, really big. So that would be the other angle I would take on that question, is like, you can be multidisciplinary or really make an effort to become a deep domain expert in something you feel passionate about or that you love.
Yeah. And the other thing that I heard from the multidisciplinary aspect was, you know, it's also just exposing yourself to different arenas, because at the end of the day, whether you see the connection or not, they all connect. And I think it's really powerful being able to take a bird's eye view and also be in the thick of what you're exceptional at, and expose yourself to new terminology and like how things work in other areas.
It's such a privilege to be able to travel, and a lot of people choose not to, and they think, well, I have everything here. There's nothing for me to see. But what you're talking about, Naomi, is a lot like learning a different language, thinking about a different culture, observing those things, and like figuring out, how do I, even if it's for a short while, how do I integrate myself? How do I respect this? And there's so many learnings. It is, I liken a lot of what you're saying to just travel even, you know?
This episode is brought to you in collaboration with Invest Ottawa, Ottawa's lead economic development agency for knowledge-based industries, and with critical support of the title sponsor of International Women's Month, BDC Capital's Thrive Venture Fund, we teamed up to produce this special podcast series to celebrate women leading in Ottawa.
Something I've been really fascinated by is what's happening in the gig economy. Part of, I don't even think we glossed over it in this interview, but you also, you know, besides working at PwC on the accounting side and working at the executive level at Nix, you also spent some time in the media industry, working in entertainment alongside content creators and producers and actors. And so I'm wondering, like, what it meant for you to play and bring your business acumen to creative organizations. What did it mean during that time to be in that space?
Yeah, for sure. Look, creatives are a really unique breed of people. And sometimes part of you is extremely creative. And I think the idea is you want to feel like anything and everything is possible. That's sort of a basic tenet of, you know, being in that industry. You want to be able to paint a clean canvas every single day. You want to be able to freelance. And not every business person can work effectively with that, you know, constant machinations of like, let's go here. No, let's go here. Oh my God, I've got a new idea. I personally love that energy. Even if I can't work like that all the time, I really thrive being around that energy. I'm inspired. So for me, ironically, working with creative people actually meant being creative, because it means, how do you figure out their visions and bringing them to life within business realities? That takes a lot of creative thinking, right? Like parameters, like finances. You only have so much money to work with. It kind of means supporting their journeys and figuring out how to come up with like flexible parameters to do that. It means speaking their language. And I think my superpower is identifying with them a lot. And I think I was able to do that because I was inspired by them, inspired by the courage, inspired by the vision. And it's interesting because if you fast forward to today, as I work with all these amazing entrepreneurs, they're also dreaming up incredible vision around how they can advance some of the world's biggest problems. And I think there's a real parallel to that in what's helped me be really effective in working with them, because I continue to be really inspired by them. And what I've been doing for the last number of years is figuring out how to make their business realities come to life within these, you know, parameters. You only have so much money and you only have so much cash and you only have so much time, you know? So I think that was a really important part of my journey, working with creatives and them resonating with me and me resonating with them.
Okay, so for the people who are not blessed enough to have you as an advisor and are dreaming up ideas, you know, we talked, you know, ahead of hitting record, how the gig economy is blowing up and it's showing no signs of slowing down, and whether people are, you know, their primary income sources are coming from something that they've created on their own, or they have a full-time job and do, you know, have a side hustle. What are some like important considerations and questions that people need to ask or that need to be asked around building a business around their skills?
Yeah. First of all, I think it takes courage to do that, because it's easy to be in a 9-to-5 job that has a lot of drudgery, that's paying you steadily, where you might be doing reasonably well, but your heart is not on fire. And you get up every morning and you're just like, is it Friday yet? Friday yet? Like, it's, you know, it's easy. And a lot of people need to do that for a bunch of really practical reasons. And that's fine. Not everyone can decide to venture off on their own. But just as you said, with the gig economy today, what's super interesting is you can pursue multiple avenues and multiple passions, right? It doesn't take much capital sometimes to start thinking about what you're really good. You know, I brought up the example, just, you know, purely illustrative of that growth marketing idea. Like, let's say you're like an amazing growth marketer. Like, there's nothing stopping you from going out and deciding to build your own, hang out your own shingle and start working with a bunch of companies on something you're really good at and you feel really passionate about and scaling that, right? But simultaneously, you might be into baking, and like maybe you want a baking business or whatever it is. And I think this idea of it's like one thing, I don't know what I'm good at, but I know what I really love. I think stepping back and brainstorming all the things that really make you passionate, and you don't have to immediately come up with a business idea around all of them. Start with one thing. Start with one thing and do more of it. Do more, a little more of it every single day. Maybe it becomes a business idea. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's just something you pursue as a hobby. But more and more, I'm meeting so many people that have three or four side hustles because they're like, I just love doing it. Has nothing to do with my day job, or maybe it'll become my day job. But I'm really excited about doing it and all the people I'm meeting. And I can't tell you how many people, like this incredible woman with amazing energy. She works at a juice bar around the corner from me, and I see her early in the morning, and we have this incredible energy exchange at the beginning of the week. She told me the other day, like, she works at the juice bar. She's like, I've started doing video production. I love producing videos. I never imagined I would do it. She said it started as a hobby, and then someone asked me if I wanted to do it at an event. She's like, and now I've got three customers, and I'm up all night figuring out how to do this. And I don't know, I stood there so filled with like excitement and energy. I could see that she was so stoked about it. And that's a perfect example of like, she works at the juice bar during the day because she's passionate about health and nutrition. Yeah. And then by night, she's this video producer, right? So, cool. Yeah, like pursuing multiple avenues, I think, is really important. And also, just because you decide to pursue a quote unquote gig, nothing means you're like married to that idea for the next 10 years. Like, you do it as long as it makes you excited and happy. And then maybe there's another thing that happens after that. And I think we're afraid of starting things in the gig economy because we feel like there has to be a huge commitment that goes alongside mm-hmm. with that. And that's not necessarily true.
Right. Yeah. And I can already hear the individuals that are saying, you know, not everyone is suited, you know, to start their own business. And I understand and appreciate both sides. But now is a particularly challenging climate where even like the most, what we consider the most stable industries or sectors are also laying off a lot of people, right? Like from government to tech. And so for me, like I'm on the extreme of, it's just like a practical thing to have multiple sources of income and think about how you can be a little bit more creative in what you're working on.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. It might even be that like you, if you have three gigs, you love one of them and maybe not so much love for the other two, but that's okay too. Right.
Right.
Nothing's saying, well, if I'm not passionate about all three, then I shouldn't pursue any. So.
Mm-hmm. So today as partner of BDC Capital's Thrive Venture Fund, you mentioned a little bit about the types of companies that you invest in, those that are solving big challenges in the world. And you're really like a thought partner and a strategic partner to a lot of different founders. And so what are some of the biggest challenges that you're seeing founders grapple with? And what have been some of the most interesting problems that you've helped them overcome?
First of all, I would say so many aspects of what I do right now are really interesting. I feel really privileged to have been doing this for a number of years and working with so many founders. And as you can imagine, these entrepreneurs are like incredible visionaries. They're scientists, they're engineers, they're business leaders, and they have so much courage and vision to really be thinking about groundbreaking innovation, right? And I'm really, really humbled to work with them. There are a lot of complex aspects to the job. Like, you're helping founders figure out how to raise capital and what it means to raise capital, how to solve some pretty hairy problems in their businesses, right? Figuring out sometimes how to pivot. Like, they might be in completely the wrong space. They need to figure out how to pivot and potentially start all over again. Like, that's super scary. And so figuring out how to hurdle all those things, I find super interesting. You know, obviously not everyone does. And I think too, certainly with the Thrive Venture Fund, because we invest in women-led companies, knowing that less than 3% of all venture capital is going into women-led companies means understanding that the work I do every day, it's not like a light switch flips on and suddenly that 3% becomes 50%. Like the work that we're doing has a very incremental impact, yeah. Tiny incremental. It's not like a big splash. And that can be discouraging sometimes, right? Knowing that like it's about every single day, teeny tiny steps, not one big thing. But if I kind of comment on what's one of the biggest challenges that I see, founders have so much at stake. They've made so many sacrifices. Some of them have taken loans out on their homes. They've foregone income for several years to finance their businesses. And despite all those best intentions, their businesses don't perform, don't survive. And that's just the statistic, right? It's just the statistic when you're in that early stage. Yeah. Watching that happen is really hard, you know? And sometimes it's about having the most amazing product, but not being in the right timing, not knowing how to get it to market effectively, not having the right team. Sometimes it's the opposite. You can have all those things, but you just don't have the right, just don't have a product that can do that. And so I think one of the most challenging things is really trying to help support companies through that. By far, though, the hairiest situations I've been involved in is when companies are like minutes away from running out of cash. And you look around the room and you realize they're not even able to pay all these people in this room. And there's so many people that are depending on this company's survival right now. And then you go into crazy high gear to figure out, okay, who can we start calling? Like, let's literally get on the phone, start calling people to put in some money into this business. Let's come up with a plan simultaneously on how to strip this down to the bare bones and strip this product down to the bare bones so we can sell it to like a single customer that's going to help the company survive for another 3 months. And then let's come up with the next plan. And that's really what it is. It's being super resourceful, thinking on your feet, being really nimble, picking up the phone and calling people, because failure is not an option. Failure is not an option when you're someone that is, you know, a founder, an entrepreneur. You don't go into it to fail. Right. It's never the intention, but you have to maintain that failure is not an option mindset throughout. And as a partner to these businesses, I sort of feel like we need to mirror that same mindset.
Oh, you just took us all on a roller coaster. And I can imagine for the folks and yourself who are knee deep in those types of challenges every day, I think having a strong why, and I feel like you know exactly why you're in those spaces and the impact that you've been able to have is phenomenal.
I tell you that if you don't attach yourself to a bigger why, because 90% of the days suck as a founder. And it's so glamorized. It's like, oh my gosh, it's so amazing. I'm a startup founder. Like I'm on a conference panel and I'm like, you know, in this article and I'm, oh my gosh, like the majority of the days are so hard. So hard. And if you don't attach yourself to a bigger reason, like because you love the customer you're aiming to serve, you love the market you're in, you're leaving a huge impact behind, social impact. There's so many reasons. And if you don't have that bigger why, you really don't stand a fighting chance. So I couldn't agree with you more. Like attaching yourself to a bigger why is imperative.
Mona, you're also a mother of two. And so I'm curious to know what you've navigated personally and like what have been the conversations in your circle around parenthood and also having this incredible career that you've built too.
I feel like I can't espouse a lot of wisdom here because I don't think I've still figured it out, if I'm being honest. It's a really long game. But what I can say is what I have learned is there's honestly no such thing as a perfect balance. And I used to tell myself, like, maybe I can carve out a certain schedule and certain hours every day. I portion my time. I focus on motherhood. I focus on work. I've tried everything, but inevitably it never works consistently, especially when you're someone that you know, where your career is really important and you have lots of pulls on you. And a few years ago, I realized actually the best word for me was not balance, but actually the word harmony. And that feeling of harmony actually happens over a long period of time, not in a given day, not in a given week, because sometimes work fully takes the front seat and that's okay. Sometimes it just has to take the front seat. And then sometimes my family takes the full front seat and that's okay too, right? And work has to take a back seat. But I guess I've learned to step back and say overall over the last 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, am I feeling that word harmony? If yes, great. I'm getting it right. If no, okay, what isn't working here? And that's really been my approach. And there's some days where I constantly feel guilty about prioritizing one thing over the other. And I realize like that's a no-win situation. So I've learned to step back and really kind of just evaluate how I feel over a period of time. And that for me, that word harmony is what comes up for me around how I manage all those.
Your full life. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. A music term too.
No, it is. Very, very true. Yeah. But
thank you, Mona. It's been a pleasure to speak with you and learn a little bit more about your world, and I think appreciate also the perspectives that you bring into the different aspects of your world. This is a fun question. And also, I'm just very curious, what is the biggest misconception that people have about you?
Biggest misconception. I'm going to go back to what I said earlier about, because of my pedigree, my background, being in business and finance, people meet me and they think she's going to be like, really hard ass and very serious and like very technical and cold and robotic. Mm. And then people meet me or get to know me and realize it like the opposite couldn't be more true. I try to bring a lot of empathy into what I do. I bring like the word human into the equation around what I do. And I think that there's a big misconception just around the career path that I can be in, especially in venture capital, right? There's a lot of misconceptions about what that can be like. And I think people meet me and walk away with maybe a different opinion.
I love that. For the audience, when it comes, because you're in so many different rooms, what has been something like across the industry or in your industry specifically that you are keeping your eye on right now and something that maybe we should look into and learn more about?
I mean, one thing that is like right in our backyard is, and I think about it a lot, is how generative AI is going to radically transform the way we live, because the way it's happened just in the last like 12 to 18 months has been like just incredible. And I'm sure you read this too, kind of tying it back into creative example, but you know, the idea that filmmakers can make short movies now with a single prompt really blows my mind, right? Authors can write an entire novel with a single command. And we think about music, we've talked about music and art and all those things, and all that's going to dramatically change as we know it. Some things for good, some things maybe not for good. And I think in the industry I'm in, as we think about innovation and transformation and big changes in the world, that's definitely something that I think we can keep our eye on around how it's going to change the way we live. And in a few years, right? Not dozens and dozens of years away, like short order, which is kind of amazing when you think about it.
Yeah, every time I ask that question, AI is the thing that comes up.
Not surprised.
Of the time. Yeah. Thank you, Mona. It was, again, such an honor to speak with you today. What is the best place for people to connect with you online?
Oh, super. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation. Folks can reach out to me on LinkedIn if they like. I'm pretty happy to respond there. So happy to share. You know, as you share my contact info, happy for people to reach out to me there.
Amazing. Thank you, Mona. Thank you, everyone who has taken the time to listen to this episode on the Power of Why podcast. We will catch you in the next one.
Thank you for listening to the Power of Why podcast. You can find the show notes at www.naomihiley.com. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to The Power of Why on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. This episode was brought to you in collaboration with Invest Ottawa and with critical support from BDC Capital's Thrive Venture Fund, the title sponsor of International Women's Month 2024. We've teamed up to produce this special series featuring six inspirational leaders. Visit www.investottawa.ca/IWM to learn more.